Welcome to Spark Your Fire Podcast, sparking your interest in Australian property and finance. Here's your hosts, Jazz and David.
G'day everyone, welcome back to another episode of Spark Your Fire. I'm your host, David Shee, and with me today is our usual co-host, Jazz Stana. Jazz, how are you doing today?
I'm really good, David. How are you, my friend?
Mate, I am awesome. I'm awesome. And today we've got another awesome guest on the show, haven't we?
Yeah, we definitely do. We have got Roger Montgomery from Montgomery Investment Fund.
Thanks for having me on the show, guys.
Oh, it's a pleasure, mate. It's a pleasure. So, Roger, just I was quickly looking at your website as well on the fund itself. Montgomery Investment Management Fund is basically owned by the staff itself, right?
That's correct. Yeah, we have a number of funds. We have a global team with an office in Sydney and an office in New York. We have a completely separate small companies team. And then we have our all-cap domestic funds management team. So there's three teams, two of which are domestic and one is global.
Right, okay. So and also you have published a book in the past. I think the book name is Valuable, right?
Yeah, look, I was very fortunate. I wrote a book after I sold a business. I had a 12-month non-compete period. And in that time, I decided to write a book. To my great surprise, a book on value investing became a bestseller within about 14 weeks of release. I'd never expected an investment book to become a bestseller, but it's been a very, very enduring message in that book about how to invest in shares. And how to identify value.
Right. Okay. So it's it purely is how to invest in shares, nothing to do with the real estate as such, and finding the value investments.
Yeah, the principles of value investing apply to all assets, but that book is specifically about investing in shares in the stock market.
Right. Okay. Now, I was looking at your website, mate. If the numbers are still accurate, the total funds under management currently you guys have got is roughly about $1.44 billion?
Yeah, that sounds about right. I mean, it moves every day, of course, as the market moves up and down and as investors put money in or take money out. But that's about the number at the moment, yep.
Yep, and roughly about 8,000 clients, oddish.
Yeah, I'll have to take your word for that. I don't count them.
To be precise, it's 7850.
Okay.
Anyways, only goes up, by the way.
Roger, so I've listened to some of your stuff in the past, and I have honestly learned a fair bit from all the appearances that you've made at various places. So now, I don't exactly remember the date. Unfortunately, I don't have the date, but at some point you called for a 40% correction in the Australian property market.
That is not correct. I said individual properties, there'll be individual properties whose prices might fall by 40%. Mm-hmm. But we were actually forecasting a 10 to 15% fall for Australian property in aggregate, but with individual properties that may fall by as much as 40%. And in fact, when I wrote that, some properties had already fallen by a third. So it wasn't a big call to suggest that. But by no means are we suggesting that the entire property market would fall 40%.
Right, okay. So 10 to 15% the correction. So that's the correction that's already happened?
That's already done. So that forecast that you were referring to, that would have been, I'm guessing, 2 or 3 years ago, probably 2016, so it might have been 3 years ago. And then that transpired. But what we didn't know at the time was that there would be action by David Murray through the Financial System Inquiry. We didn't know. Actually, we did know about that. That was already happening. What we didn't know is how APRA would respond to David Murray's Financial System Inquiry, and consequently, they tightened credit, as everyone knows now. What we did know at the time was that banks' return on equity was going to be reduced by the fact that they would have to have a lot more capital to meet the unquestionably strong requirements set out by David Murray. We did know that their mortgage risk weights were going to be reduced. In other words, for every dollar of equity that the banks had, they wouldn't be able to lend as much, and that would be restrictive for credit. But really, the overarching story way back then was a story of oversupply. And we're still digesting that oversupply now. And consequently, we're seeing a cliff in a number of things. There's been a cliff in land sales. So land sales are absolutely slumping. Land sales lead building approvals. Building approvals are down 40% year on year. And consequently, there's going to be, unfortunately, a fair bit of pain for tradies and people who work directly in residential construction, because the pipeline of new construction work is going to fall by between 40 and 50%. That's obvious. And in fact, our channel checks, where we've spoken to CFOs and CEOs of property development companies, they've told us that their pipeline is down 50%. And consequently, that means after Christmas, there's going to be a fair bit less work on for builders who are just finishing up on properties that were ordered, you know, a year or 2 years ago.
Right. So 40 to 50% drop in construction, that is a huge number. I mean, that will have some implications on the economy, surely. I mean, construction is one of the biggest sectors.
Right. Yeah, it will. So we already know. So the numbers are already in. We know that approvals are down 40%. They're down from a run rate of 250,000 properties a year to 150,000 properties a year. So we've had 100,000 drop. That is a leading indicator for construction activity. And so that'll be that. You'll see that as the pipeline starts to decline. So these things are already in train, and that's why the Reserve Bank of Australia is cutting rates more aggressively than perhaps would have been predicted a year or two ago, because the construction industry in its entirety is the third largest employer in the country. The construction industry employs 9.6% of the workforce, and 37% of that of the construction industry is employed directly in residential construction. In other words, 3.5% of the Australian workforce is directly employed by the residential construction industry, and that's slowing down. And so there's going to be a lot of bricklayers, a lot of sparkies, a lot of plumbers, a lot of chippies, tilers, roofers, you name it, concreters. There's going to be a lot less work on for them. And we're already seeing that anecdotally. So we know, for example, this time last year, you could not find a bricklayer. And if you could find a bricklayer, they were charging about $1.80 a brick. And today, there are bricklayers literally everywhere looking for work. And they're offering to do the work for $1.20 a brick, even less in some cases. So even if those tradies get some jobs, they're not going to be earning as much money, because there's a lot less building activity going on. And that's just an after effect, or if you like, a consequence of the oversupply that was being built a few years ago, which obviously kept everyone employed. But now that that's been built, because by definition an oversupply means it's going to take a while to digest, there's a lot less new work on.
Interesting.
And yep. So I was just going to add, in reference to your question about the impact on the economy, well, you've got 3.5% of the workforce with 50% less work, and then that's the second largest employer in Australia is the retail industry, and presumably those builders and anyone who has a trade in the building industry, they're going to be spending less at the shops. In fact, we know from a conversation that I had with Guy DeBell, who's the Reserve Bank Assistant Governor. I had lunch with him as a guest of the National Australia Bank a few weeks ago. The Reserve Bank of Australia is the banker for the Australian Taxation Office. They're the government's bank. And so they could see money going out when everybody was getting that $1,000 rebate, that refund. And there was a big surge in early tax lodgements, or tax return lodgements. And we thought that money might go into retail, that extra $1,000 might go into retail, but in fact it didn't. It went to pay off mortgages. So we know that retail's doing it tough, and it's probably going to get tougher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fair. Just on the – so because obviously there's going to be impact clearly on the economy with the low with the unemployment numbers shooting up probably because of the construction. What does that mean for the interest rates? So does that mean that RBA is going to try and cut more rates to boost the economy?
Well, that will be dependent on whether the economy responds to the rate cuts that have already been effected. And so if we see people running out and buying house and land packages and builders start being employed again, then the RBA will hold off on further rate cuts. But what the RBA knows is the rate cuts aren't particularly effective at getting people to spend money. In fact, if anything, rate cuts are signalling to people that the economy is doing it tough. And consequently, if the economy is doing it tough, people don't want to go out and spend. They're sort of pulling their heads in and battening down the hatches, so to speak, and tightening their belts. So the rate cuts are required, but they're not having the required effect. And so that's why you've seen the Reserve Bank coming out and sort of goading the government to spend more money on infrastructure or provide more tax relief and so on.
Fair enough. So
Roger, can I have a question? In relation to, say oversupply, but did you specifically mean Sydney and Melbourne markets, or are you talking about nationally?
Oh, no, you can't talk about nationally. I think people who talk about nationally, you know, you can't draw a conclusion about a specific property based on national numbers.
Yep.
And I think it's really important to understand that, you know, there are individual markets within the property market. I mean, you look at the eastern suburbs of Sydney, it hasn't gone down at all. So, you know, the same for probably Mosman. So, you know, there are individual markets that will have their, you know, they'll march to their own drumbeat. And it's not necessarily the case that if I talk about aggregate numbers, it doesn't mean I'm saying all property is going down or all property is bouncing, or, you know, that you're going to have to look at the individual market that you enter. You know, and I purchased a property on the Upper North Shore in Sydney 2 weeks before the federal election, when everybody thought Labor was going to win. And the property was going to be absolutely hammered. And I bought that property for less than the cost of replacing the house. So I got the land for free, or I bought the land and I got the house
for free.
Got the
house for free.
So, you know, and then 2 weeks later, of course, the Libs won and property has bounced, you know, maybe 15%, 10 to 15%. And then in that, you know, only a few weeks ago, I sold our previous property. So, you can do well in property irrespective of what the aggregate numbers are telling you. And I'm telling you that the construction industry is looking weak, but that's not necessarily meaning that property prices are going to go down. It just means the construction industry is going to do it tough.
Yep. And obviously with the oversupply situation in Sydney and Melbourne, do you foresee it become a feast to feminine kind of situation? In other words, all of a sudden there was an undersupply in a few years' time because of the construction pipeline literally going down as much
absolutely.
As what you quoted. Yeah, 100%. So in that case,
give it three years, and then, you know, you probably 3 or 4 years and you're in an undersupply situation again. And if the economy starts to recover, then people will start to think, hey, interest rates aren't going to go down any further. They'll start going up again.
Yep.
And if people do start believing that, whether that's right or wrong, people are going to rush to buy property. And you're going to see property prices recovering.
Which is a normal recovery cycle rather than what we're currently seeing in like a debt inflated, initiated type.
I've been investing now for almost 30 years, and I've seen 3 or 4 really big asset cycles and various credit cycles, and you know it's pretty easy to read.
Uh-huh. That's an interesting fact. Would you be able to share with our listeners in terms of the key cycle, the asset cycles that you have experienced in the last 30 odd years?
Yeah, sure. So we had the we had in 1994 we had a major bond rout, and we saw bond prices crash, and then that was the first one. The second big event was the 1999 boom in technology stocks. Basically, anything that attached a .com to the back of its name did extraordinarily well. And when I say it did extraordinarily well, I mean the share price went up a lot. It then subsequently crashed. And then we had the GFC. And prior to the GFC, a good 6 months before it started, Robert Gottliebson and I gave a presentation to a bunch of clients of ours. And I remember saying, you'll wake up. That was in 2007, and I remember telling clients that you'll wake up one day in 2008 and the Dow Jones will be down 1,000 points overnight. And the reason for believing that at the time was that we could see that there was a very large number of loans that had been extended for the purchase of property in the United States to people who couldn't afford to pay them. So you had situations where you had literally, quite literally, Mexican strawberry pickers who were earning maybe $14,000 or $15,000 a year being extended $700,000 and $800,000 loans to buy property. They then had these holiday, these loans had these holiday periods. They were called subprime loans because of the inability of the borrower to actually pay it back.
Yep.
But they had these holiday periods where they didn't have to pay back the principal or the interest for some years. Mm. But then, of course, there would come a time where they had to reset and they'd start having to pay interest and principal and they wouldn't be able to. And that was going to all start occurring in 2008. And, of course, then we had the GFC. So there's three. And I think we're seeing another one right now. We're seeing a bubble in we're seeing a bubble for bonds because we're seeing negative yielding corporate bonds, not only negative yielding sovereign bonds, but negative yielding corporate bonds. And what that means is that the price people are paying for the bond means if they hold that bond to maturity, then the remaining interest payments and the principal being paid back isn't enough to give you a profit on what you've paid for the bond. In fact, you're guaranteeing a loss. That's what a negative yielding bond is. So you're paying such a high price for the bond that if you hold it to maturity, you lose money. And then, of course, they're corporate bonds. So there's about $1.1 trillion of negative yielding corporate bonds in the market at the moment. Some of those companies will go broke. And if they do, then you lose your money. So investors are going to lose money if the company goes broke, and they're going to lose money if they hold it to maturity. So you sort of scratch your head and you say, well, why on earth would they do that? Well, they're betting that somebody else will pay more for that bond from them down the track. So that by definition is a bubble. When people stop thinking about the income, they stop thinking about the long run value, they start just thinking that it'll keep going up the way it's gone up before, that by definition is a bubble. And so over a lifetime, if you've invested for long enough, you start to see these things, and we're seeing it now.
So if you're saying we are already seeing a recession...
I'm not saying we're seeing a recession. I'm saying where the risk of a recession is going up, and it'll certainly be higher next year, but there will definitely be a recession for anyone exposed to residential construction. They're going into a recession next year. Unless the government rescues them somehow, you know, gives everyone a paintbrush and $1,000 and says, go paint a school, they're going to have less work on, and consequently they're going to see an income recession. But that doesn't mean the entire economy goes into a recession. It doesn't really matter for them. We've got an income recession for retirees at the moment. They're earning, 1.7% on a term deposit. So if they've got $1 million in a term deposit, and Labor made a big song and dance about how rich retirees are. But if you've got $1 million sitting in a term deposit, you're earning, and you've got no job because you're retired, you're earning $17,000 interest. That is less than the poverty line in Australia. So you have to erode your capital. You have to eat into your capital in order to survive. There are retirees who are in an income recession right now. And I think a lot of people who are tradies and exposed directly to the construction industry, they will join them in an income recession next year. But that doesn't mean that the whole economy is going into recession.
Okay, let's simplify this a little bit for the listeners. For the person who's looking at investing, let's say they are in their 20s, right? They're looking at investing into different asset classes. How should they structure their portfolio best to mitigate some of these risks that are there currently?
I don't think I think trying to sidestep the risks can be a mistake. So because you could be wrong, and if you're wrong, then asset prices keep going up and then you miss out. And so the trick is not to sidestep them, but the trick is to allocate appropriate amounts to the relevant asset classes. So, for example, I'm not suggesting this is the right way to do it, but let's say you look at your portfolio and you say, okay, well, I'm going to have 30% in property, I'm going to have 30% in shares, I'm going to have 30% property, 30% shares, I might have 10% cash, that gives me 70%, I might have 10% in alternatives, that's 80%, and then, you know, I might have 10% in speculative, there's 90%, and 10% I'm just putting aside for a rainy day, you know, I might just leave that, that's not the cash to allocate to other investments, but that's just for emergencies. And so let's say they're your weightings, then what you do is you invest those percentages, and you might say, well, every 6 months or every 12 months, I'm going to rebalance the portfolio. So if the speculative shares go really well and they double, well, that's now, should have been 10%, but it's now 20%. And so I'm going to bring that back down to 10% and put the 10% profit into the other asset classes. And that's what rebalancing is. And that's what professional investors do constantly. And so I don't see that much when I talk to private investors. They tend to be wedded to a particular investment class, or they tend to be wedded to a particular theme or story. You know, you see these people out there who say, you know, gold's great, I'm just going to own gold. And, you know, gold is trading where it was however many years ago, you know, and that you've missed out on so much more profit and income by investing in other asset classes. So you get people who are wedded to stories, and then you get people who are wedded to asset classes. But really the appropriate strategy is to think about allocations to a diversified portfolio of assets, and then rebalancing those weightings every year or every 2 years or every 3 years, whatever you want it to be. And doing that in a disciplined way over a long period of time is a much better strategy than trying to sidestep the risks. Because even though I tell you that there's going to be, you know, something bad happening, or there might be downgrades in a particular asset class, I could be wrong. And consequently, you would miss out on some gains if you were to try and sidestep that. I think the best thing is to actually do what I've just described. And because if you've got a job or you've got assets producing income, then when property prices fall or shares fall, then you can use that income that you've been building up. You can actually use that to invest in more of those assets when they're cheaper. There's a phrase I was taught many years ago, and I was very fortunate to meet some very, very successful investors who took me under their wing at an early age. One of them was a gentleman named John Morrison, and I remember John telling me, he said, people get rich buying and selling, but they get wealthy buying and holding.
That's true. That's surely true. On that, Roger, I mean, the asset allocation, my personal opinion, could be completely wrong, but the shares and the property market, one way or the other, are correlated. So if the market, if something goes wrong with the global economy, or in general with the Australian economy, you'll see shares market tanking, and so will normally the real estate. Now, that doesn't mean every state in Australia will probably tank, but you'll see the impacts of it. They're kind of correlated, right?
Well, that's the case. That's the case today. But if you go back to the 80s and early 90s, that was certainly not the narrative. You know, they moved at different times, and one led the other sometimes, and then the other led the other one. So it is. It might be true now, but it's not always been the case, and I suspect it might not be the case in the future. Sorry, keep going.
Yeah. So, but then you're not really diversified. I mean, we call about diversification if the share market tanks or the real estate tanks. But the fact is that they are correlated. They are related to each other, right? So if one gets impacted, if we see S&P, the ASX going down tomorrow by whatever percent, 20-30%, that is surely going to have an impact on the real estate at the same time as well.
But what are you trying to achieve? Are you trying to build a portfolio that generates enough income for you in the future so that you can retire on that income? or are you trying to make a profit from buying and selling the assets? If you're trying to make a profit from buying and selling the assets, then yes, that's an issue. But if you're not, if you're trying to build a portfolio over time, then even if they're co-related, you'll still do very well from building the value of the income stream. And that should be the focus of investors over the very long run. It's buying assets whose income is going to grow. And if you can do that, then you'll do very, very well, no matter which asset class you're in. So I don't mind if people are buying both, if they prefer one or prefer the other, but stick within your circle of competence, and I'm sure you'll do just fine.
So the key over there is a circle of competence, or hire a professional manager.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, somebody who is an expert in that field. That's right. But then hold them to account, right? You know, I don't like people who, you know, who say, I'm going to give you some advice and you're going to pay me for that advice. But if the advice goes bad, it's, you know, it's all your fault. It's not mine. You know, I think there should be some, you know, if advisors are going to be putting people into an asset class and telling them that's what they should do, then, you know, they should be riding the wins and the losses with them. You know, so I'm not in that space. I'm not in the advice space, but I would certainly be looking for an advisor who's willing, you know, who's willing to eat their own cooking.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, Australian property market has seen some good growth over the last few decades, right?
Sure, of course it has. It's been sensational since about 1994.
But do we see that happening in the future as well? Similar kind of growth out of this particular asset class in Australia, or that is more of a dream now?
I think if you buy, remember that there's a basic tenet in investing. I'm not going to be able to predict what's going to happen over the next, you know, short term. But I think the basic tenet of investing is that if you, the lower the price you pay, the higher your return. So let's suppose at the moment there, you know, there's not very many distressed property sellers out there, right? So interest rates are low. So even though household debt is very, very high, particularly compared to income, people are still managing to pay their mortgages because they've got a job and interest rates are very, very low. So that's a good thing. So then I think that it's a difficult one to describe, but I think that I need to really reframe this another way. If you think that there's going to be an opportunity, then you prepare for that opportunity. Okay, that sounds obvious. If you believe that there's not going to be an opportunity, then you keep doing what you've always done. Now, when we talk about opportunity, I'm talking about the opportunity to buy something at good value. So I believe that at the moment there's not much opportunity to buy stuff at good value. Interest rates are very low, people have got jobs, people are paying off their mortgages, so there's very few distressed sellers in any asset class. But do you think that's always going to be the case? I don't. I think there will be a point in time where either the economy does it really tough and people lose jobs, and or interest rates go up. Either of those things could mean that there could be an increase in the number of stressed owners, which would then lead to an increase in the number of distressed sellers. And if you've got distressed sellers, then there's an opportunity to get set for a very long time. And so while I can't predict what's going to happen in the next little while, I do believe that there'll be some opportunities, particularly in the property market. Now, remember this, the property market is not driven by what people who are sitting at home in their houses, not buying and selling, it's not driven by them. They're affected by what property prices do, but property prices are ultimately driven by what I call the marginal buyer and the marginal seller. In other words, the people who do something this weekend will determine the property prices for everyone. And so it's the marginal buyer, it's that outlier that can determine prices for everyone else. So if we have a wave of forced sales anywhere in the market, then that's going to affect the price for everyone. If we, and by the way, if we have forced sellers and buyers who aren't willing to meet the market, you know, they're pulling back from the bid, then prices would fall and that'll affect prices for everyone. But that's the scenario that you need at the moment to see a wave of value appear in the property market. It's just not there at the moment. It's a long-winded answer to a short question, but I guess I'm trying to navigate that the easy answer, which is, you know, to predict where the property market's going to go.
That we sort of have already discussed. We have seen the bottom of the market, right? So unless
we've seen a bottom. I've got enough investing experience to know, never say you've seen everything. There's always new things that surprise you.
No, that's what I was going to say. Either we call that a bottom or we are going to see another bottom soon.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know what's going to happen next.
Okay, so that becomes interesting. I guess it more comes down to the personal situation of how long you can hold the asset for, and that dictates whether you enter the property market now or you wait for the time to come. And obviously, a lot of things.
I think you should be looking for value all the time. If you find a property with a distressed seller and you can buy that property at 30% less than what it sold for previously, or 40% less than what it sold for previously, does it matter if the whole market crashes or not? It doesn't matter. You've bought something that has crashed, and so you'll do just fine. With reference to income, of course, and quality, and you know, and location, and all those things, you should be always on the lookout for value. Why wait until everybody else can see it? If everybody else can see value, then you're not going to get it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. And I think, Roger, a good example is what you mentioned earlier. You bought a property just right like 2 weeks before the election. Now, you must have seen value around that time. And I guess maybe just to share with our listeners, what did you see around that and what made you decide to pull the trigger? Because you said you bought it at land value, essentially. Was it a distressed sale, for example? Or?
No, it wasn't. It was on the market. It had been advertised. I mean, it was only on the market for 18 days because I bought it.
So you pulled the trigger relatively quickly. With the election just around the corner, and as you mentioned before as well, you know, with the potential win from the Labor Party, What made you? I mean, seen the value.
Yeah.
You've seen the value.
So, do you know what I saw? Mm. I saw that there would be another election in 3 years' time. And then there'd be another election 3 years after that, another one 3 years after that.
That's a certainty we can confirm, absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, people forget. I'm often asked if I stay back at the office on budget night. And my response is, what on earth? There'll be another budget next year. So what I saw was that everyone was panicking about this election, forgetting that there would be another one if this one went badly. And so I wasn't concerned at all about that.
That's a very easy tip, I think, for the listeners who are thinking of purchasing. Just wait for the election to happen.
I don't know who to attribute this quote to, but I'm told it was a bunch of Greek philosophers who were asked to distill life, the universe, and everything into four words. And they thought about it for a very long time and apparently came back with these four words: this too will pass.
Nice. I like it.
Yeah. So, in the long run, property is driven. In the very long run, property is driven by population. You think about markets in Europe and in the United States, like New York, for example. Why is it that property is so much more expensive over there? Well, they've had a lot more population growth, and they've had a lot longer to grow that population. Australia will get there too, and Sydney and Melbourne will get there as well as the population grows. So in the long run, population drives property prices. In the shorter run, it's about credit availability, and credit availability goes through cycles. And when credit's tight, property goes down, and when credit's easy, property goes up. And you know, you want to buy when credit's tight, and your cash is most valuable when no one else has any. So if you've got cash and nobody else can get it, you're going to do pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Good. You mentioned about household debt. Now, if my stats are right, which I and I don't have the figures in front of me, but Australian household debt is right up on the top compared to some of the other countries. I think it's the second highest in the world.
It's also at a record for Australia as well. That's right.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on the in that space? I mean, that's does that form a fairly high risk?
It's really simple. It's really, yep. really simple. As long as people keep their jobs and interest rates stay low, it's not an issue. If either of those two things change, it becomes an issue, and that presents opportunity. So, you know, if that very high level of mortgage debt that people are carrying, it's not a problem if they keep their jobs and they can pay their loans because interest rates are low. But if interest rates go up and it becomes harder to pay a loan, or if they lose their jobs, then suddenly people are financially stressed. Then they may be forced to sell. And if they're forced to sell and there's not enough buyers around, prices will go down and you'll have an opportunity to buy something.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had Steve Keane on the show a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, he is someone who did forecast a 40% property fall.
He sure did. Yeah. And he still thinks it's going to happen.
Okay.
So... but one of his points was household debt is super high, right? But you've kind of answered that in your own way, and that was
the other thing. And the other thing is, property prices could go sideways for 10 years. This is a hypothetical, but property prices could go sideways for 10 years. Interest rates stay really low. People keep their jobs. They pay down that debt, and then it's not an issue.
Yeah.
So you know, so to be able to predict whether property prices are going to go up or down by just pointing to debt is I don't think that's sensible analysis, quite frankly.
Yep, no, that's fair enough, and that's a very good point. I mean, that's another way of thinking. The market doesn't have to crash to correct itself. It can just go sideways for a few years while the wages slowly increase and people pay off their debt, and the whole situation changes once again.
Exactly.
So, yep. Some good points over there. David, have you got any more questions? I do have, but they're not related to the property or shares as such. Oh,
before you jump into your comp stuff, look, just I guess, you know, Roger, with your 30 plus years of investing experiences, what are the key three lessons you could share with our listeners?
Okay, I think we might have actually
covered
said
a few
some
already.
Of them. We might have covered a few of them.
Covered a few already, but I guess, yeah.
Always think about what something is worth, and the price is not what it's worth. Mm-hmm. Price and value are two different things. So price is what you pay and value is what you get. And your job as an investor is to pay a lower price than the value you receive. So I talk about that in the first couple of chapters of my book, Valuable, and help people to understand or identify what value is compared to price, and how to see when the price is more expensive than the value. And therefore you want to zip up your wallet when you see that. So that's one lesson. The other thing I would say is the lower the price you pay, the higher your return. So you want to pay a lower price than anybody else if you can. And then the third thing I would say is learn how to recognize when people are doing silly things with money in a particular asset class, and be sure to exit well before they all do en masse. I think that's a pretty valuable lesson. I had a fourth one, but it's gone.
Three are good. They're pretty good ones, actually. Right. So now something that's not related to the asset classes anymore, but rapid fire questions for you, right?
Sure.
Aliens, believer or not?
No.
Don't believe in aliens?
No.
AI, threat to humans?
Possibly, but not yet.
How far do you see down the line, if it is?
Who knows? That depends on the speed with which legislation catches up. It depends on the stupidity of scientists. It depends on so many variables that are unpredictable. I couldn't possibly say.
Yeah, fair enough. Crypto, here to stay or a fad?
Not the current crop of currencies, but there will be a future digital currency. I'm sure of that.
That's all I had, mate. Thanks for being on the show, Roger.
Super. Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for those really interesting questions.
We learned a lot as well on the way. So I appreciate your time, and we'll definitely love to have you sometime in the future again.
So I look forward to it. Thanks, guys.
For our listeners, hope you guys are enjoying the content. And if you are, please don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes or whatever app you're using. And we will see you guys next time. Jazz and David, bye.
If you have any questions or feedback about today's episode, you can reach out to us through sparkyourfirepodcast@gmail.com. That's sparkyourfirepodcast, all one word, @gmail.com. Also, the content discussed in this episode is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals in regards to your personal situation.